Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. Today, we hear from a drug dealer and some gang members who found salvation at the kitchen stove.
Like our little tuna cans, we will fold them over, and that's what we use as a knife to cut our vegetables.
Then, we'll meet some folks who have left the boardroom for the bakery. So, let's dig in. Celebrity chef Jeff Henderson's book pitch must have been irresistible. Cooked, from the streets to the stove, from cocaine to foie gras. He does have quite a story to tell. In the late 1980s, he was a drug dealer in San Diego making $35,000 a week. He got busted, went to prison, and wound up on kitchen duty, where he had an epiphany. He actually liked to cook. After his release, he eventually made his way to some of the best restaurants on the West Coast. There, his skills making crack actually helped him master fussy French recipes. He talks about his journey with NPR's Michelle Norris.
With a great piece of steak or even lobster, you can screw up, and there are ways to cover it up so that no one will ever notice. That's not the case with foie gras. Just like when you're cooking cocaine, one miscalculation of the heat can destroy your product. With crack, if you don't babysit the pot and micromanage the process, a third of your yield can disintegrate. And with a kilo of cocaine selling at $14,500 wholesale, that is not acceptable loss.
Jeff Henderson, reading from his book. He's now the executive chef at the Cafe Bellagio in Las Vegas, where he throws himself into his work, in part as penance for all the lives he ruined when he was selling crack. With his clean-shaven head, bold eyeglasses, and almost preppy dress, the 42-year-old Henderson looks more like a product of the Culinary Institute of America, not the federal prison system.
People always ask me, say, Jeff, is there some connection between food and inmates? Because a lot of prisoners, ex-inmates, work in kitchens and restaurants. And the connection for me, I believe how my passion developed behind cooking was being hungry. And in prison, you know, your meal, eating is your the number one thing you think about. I mean, on Tuesday, you're thinking about what's for dinner on Saturday. You know, so that I think that was really the force behind me finding this hidden passion and my love for food.
So over time, you developed specialties, learned how to work with sort of the huge orders that would come through, making desserts, for instance, with
those
vast cans of fruit that would come through.
Yes. We used to get canned fruits, and they used to come in these number 10 cans. And we had a special room that we opened the number 10 cans because, you know, you can take the lids and, you know, use them as weapons. Every now and then, they would get out on the compound, and we would use the lids of cans, like our little tuna cans, and we would fold them over, and that's what we use as a knife to cut our vegetables.
Mm-hmm. And, I imagine to cut something else also.
Well, I'm sure some inmates use them for other things as well. But my homemade knife was strictly used for prepping. Yes.
Were you also, as you tried to develop your cooking skills, limited by the kinds of ingredients that you had access to in prison?
Yes. I mean, our main ingredient was salt and pepper. You know, we had different seasonings from spice companies and whatnot. But we didn't have the seasonings and different spices that we use today to enhance flavors of food. And, you know, we pull different pieces in the kitchen. Like, say, for instance, we had spreads that we would do back at the unit. Like, we used to make these nachos. And we used to buy Top Ramen noodles just to get the seasoning package out because it brought a whole different flavor to whatever we were seasoning. And on the holidays, we got these Petrit Farms gift packages where they have the sausages and the gourmet cheeses. So at Christmas time, we were able to buy like four or five of them. So we would use our little metal to cut the sausages and fry them in a microwave. And then somebody would bring the packages from the Top Ramen, and different inmates would smuggle something out the kitchen to add to this nacho spread, whether it was an onion, whether it was boiled eggs, or whatever the case may be.
Now, you said you didn't know much about cooking when you arrived in prison, but you had spent time in the kitchen, not cooking food, though.
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, I was in during a dark period in my life, you know, when I was selling cocaine. And I used to cook cocaine. You know, I used to take 1 kilo of powder cocaine and turn it into 2 kilos of crack. And actually, the comparison of blanching vegetables is the same technique for making crack cocaine. You know, there was blanching and ice chilled water was involved and different ingredients that you would use in the kitchen. I don't want to talk about everything that I used to make it because I don't want to you know, put that recipe out there. But it was very similar. You know, you have to micromanage the pot to make sure that the cocaine doesn't overcook or it can, you know, disintegrate.
Jeff, I noticed something since we're sitting here on the studio together. Mm-hmm. And as I look you in the eye, when you talk about your old life, it seems like it's actually difficult for you to go there right now.
Sometimes it is. But I always will be living in my past. And I have to share my story. And it's therapeutic for me sometimes. Because when I think about it, I think about the effect and the devastation crack cocaine had in the African-American community. It's painful sometimes.
You know, we shouldn't leave the impression that the road to success for you was an easy one. It sounds like you had a very difficult time finding your way in professional kitchens once you left prison, dealing with the competition, dealing with people who only saw your past and didn't acknowledge your skills in the kitchen. You wrote a letter to the owner of Gadsby's restaurant, a popular restaurant in Los Angeles,
yes.
Pled with him, made your case, said, please hire me, please give me a chance.
Yes.
Why do you think he did that?
I think because I was persistent, and I think at one point he felt that, you know what, let me give this guy a chance. He probably won't make it. Then I don't have to say no to him no more. And he didn't answer my letter at first. And I made my way to his restaurant, and I came there twice a week, every other week, asking him, said, Chef, I really like opportunity. I wash dishes. I don't care. I said, I really want to work for you. And one day he gave me a chance. And not only did I wash dishes, I cleaned his bathrooms. And I was the first one in, last one out. I came to work 3-4 hours early. He'd be like, Henderson, no overtime today. I said, I know, Chef. I just want to be here. You know, and I would do everything. I mean, everything that I could to prove to him that I was capable and worthy of this job. And I was proud. As a black man in the high-end food world, he inspired things in me other than cooking. He taught me how to speak and act and be around people from corporate America. Because when I came home from prison, I was pretty buff from lifting weights. And I had to reimage myself. You know, I had to cut the hair off my face. I had to learn to smile. I had to take makeup and cover my earring hole up. I had to make the whole prison demeanor go away. So when people met me after a period of time, you know, they were like, wow, I can't believe this guy actually was in prison. You know, I got my teeth fixed. You know, I took away all those stereotypes to be accepted. And it worked for me. You know?
You had to learn how to smile.
Yes. Shake hands,
something
walk,
you didn't do much in,
sit up in
9
chair,
years
right?
In prison.
No, because in prison you have a image of toughness and you become hardened over the years. Yes.
In your restaurant now,
yes.
Do you set aside a place on the line for someone who's trying to find their way in society, someone who's an ex-con, someone who's left prison?
Yeah. I don't set a job away for them, but I give them the equal opportunity that I would give a kid who comes out of the Culinary Institute of America. And I look for cooks who come to me with passion first, who's focused and driven and have a purpose. I don't look for guys who come in who know everything. If you're teachable and you're learnable, despite your past, I'm going to give you an opportunity. And as soon as you screw up one time, you're out of here, and I let them know right up. Everyone gets out of prison, they look me up.
Jeff Henderson, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
That was NPR's Michelle Norris with Jeff Henderson, author of Cooked, From the Streets to the Stove, From Cocaine to Foie Gras. Kitchen Duty has also given members of LA street gangs a second chance. A bakery run by former gang members reopened in 2007, nearly a decade after it was destroyed by fire. It's part of Homeboy Industries. That's a rehabilitation program headed by Father Gregory Boyle, who's worked with young people from more than 600 LA street gangs. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
A mariachi band serenaded the crowd of Angelenos celebrating the new Homeboy Industries complex in downtown L.A. During yesterday's grand opening, polite ex-offenders and former gang members hobnobbed with L.A.'s police chief, the sheriff, and Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, who sampled delicacies at the Homegirl Cafe.
I got me a taco. Muy sabroso, huh?
Villaraigosa says in a city of 39,000 gang members, the nonprofit center provides job training for those trying to escape the gang lifestyle.
These are kids who are getting a second chance, who are getting an opportunity to develop a skill and an alternative to a life of crime and gangs.
With nearly $12.5 million in donations, Homeboy Industries now has a new building for its headquarters, including the cafe, a merchandise store, a tattoo removal clinic, also a new bakery after the original one burned down in an electrical fire 8 years ago.
We ask you to bless this building, which has a strong spirit, so that we will learn to fly in an order that by the...
Father Greg Boyle, Father G, or just G as he's affectionately known, prayed for the new headquarters before ceremonially breaking bread baked by the homeboys. 20 years ago, the Jesuit priest created Homeboy Industries to help those who were rejected by society.
You know, this is a part of a smart response to the gang reality. But in the early days, that was a tougher sell because the demonizing was so complete. 20 years ago, we got death threats, bomb threats, and hate mail.
Father Boyle says he no longer hears much from critics who accuse him of harboring criminals. In fact, he gets much love from city officials, police, and thousands of homeboys and homegirls he's counseled and trained over the years. Take Marcus Luna, who got out of prison 3 months ago. The 35-year-old is covered head to toe with gang tattoos, which made it hard to get hired before now.
If they see a tattoo on you or something, they think you're violent. Father gives you the benefit of the doubt.
Luna says kneading and baking bread has taught him a new way of thinking.
I learned to be patient. It's like a meditation or something.
Another baker, Eric Joshua, says he's changed from how he used to roll in South Central L.A.
Selling crack, that was my life. Instead of planting dough, I was planting baking soda, you know what I mean?
Baking cocaine.
Yeah.
Joshua says it's not easy to break away from the gangs that claim you as family, but like him, 15-year-old Marilyn Villanueva now works side by side with her former rivals.
I was tired at first when I came in here. I was with a little attitude of not caring and everything.
And then how did that change?
I started talking to this girlfriend and everything was set aside. Now I'm moving on, you know, and I love working with these girls because I grew attached to them. It's not making a change and I owe it all to Father Greg and I'm really thankful.
LA's homeboys and homegirls often like to quote Father Boyle, who says nothing stops a bullet like a job. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
Another trend in L.A., swapping your power suit for an apron. Rob Schmitz of member station KQED reports.
A few years ago, Candace and Charles Nelson thought they had a great idea. They were going to leave their jobs as high-paid investment bankers to set up a shop that would only sell cupcakes. They called it Sprinkles. Candace's friends wondered if the couple had lost their marbles.
We were kind of the laughing joke amongst all of our friends, and it was also at the height of sort of South Beach diet, Atkins. No one in L.A., or in the country for that matter, was eating carbs.
But they are now. On this day, dozens of customers patiently wait in a line that snakes out onto the sidewalk. After waiting half an hour, they pay $3.50 for a cupcake. Sprinkles' rich, frosting-laden gourmet delights have sent this city into a sugar-induced tizzy. Celebrities love them. And now tour buses make regular stops here. Nelson knew things were going well when she saw people standing in the middle of the street taking pictures of the bakery.
Which still blows my mind to this day.
Why all the fuss? Theories range from a growing demand for foods made with nothing but the best ingredients to folks self-medicating with sweets during a strained economy. Rebecca Mars of the California School of Culinary Arts says her school added its first evening and weekend patisserie program in order to meet the growing demand of mid-career professionals.
And they're now wanting to pursue maybe a passion they've always had. They've always, you know, done baking on the side. But now they've seen some success with other businesses like the Sprinkles. And they've seen, you know, okay, if they're successful in doing it, you know, I can probably be as well.
Kirk Rosberg has seen this trend, too. He's the head of the California Retail Bakers Association. In his 23 years of running his bakery, he's never seen so many intern applications from folks with mature resumes.
Well, free labor is free labor. We have a luxury now of interviewing for the spot because it's becoming somewhat of a coveted position for them to get a job.
One of these young entrepreneurs is former real estate developer Allison Winston. She seems to have taken a page out of the Sprinkles book. She's spruced up the breakfast of choice for beat cops.
This is a mocha cake with our homemade espresso glaze. This is a Vermont maple on a vanilla cake made with real Vermont maple.
No, these aren't delicate French pastries. They're donuts, and they've never looked better.
This is raspberry filled. We have actually a lingonberry.
Lingonberry? In case you're wondering, it's kind of like a Scandinavian cranberry. MSN just listed Fratelli's as one of the 10 best donut shops in the country. But not everyone is going gourmet. Some are seeking out a niche market. Office assistant Rebecca Foster specializes in baked goods for goths, as in gothic, as in people who embrace the darker side of life.
I do want to represent the needs of the gothic community, those that can't go into regular bakeries and order black roses and feel comfortable doing that.
Foster's baked goods are aimed at life events many would rather forget. She makes a decadent divorce cake with black roses. She packages her Valentine's Day truffles in a tempered chocolate coffin.
Not everybody wants pink and sweet and lovely. And for a lot of people, this is lovely and this is beautiful.
Foster plans to leave her office job by the end of next year to focus solely on her baking. She says life is too short to put her sweet dreams on hold. And like any true goth, she's very much aware of her own mortality. For NPR News, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
Baking also plays an unlikely role in Kosovo's economy. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley has more.
On a muddy side street in a trendy area of Pristina, bizarrely named Peyton Place, the windows of the crowded Café Odisseia are fogged up on a cold winter day. The French bakery just opened its doors a few months ago, but is already popular with Pristina's young café crowd. Caspi Shahar, one of the Odisseia's three Israeli owners, says Kosovo's relatively undeveloped market in the heart of Europe offers great opportunity.
I think it's a good place for business, especially because that the big jump is still ahead. There is a difference between West Europe and this area, and I think that in 15, 20 years, this difference will be decreased or finished.
Shahar says he doesn't find Pristina a particularly tense place, at least no more so than Tel Aviv. And Shahar says Kosovo has some business advantages over its Balkan neighbors, like using the euro as its currency. Still, he admits there are plenty of risks here. Not only is Kosovo already in one of the poorest regions in Europe, but ethnic conflict and war in the last two decades have further destroyed its economy.
This is the pastries from this morning, chocolate croissant, butter croissant, potato filas. Filas is Israeli.
29-year-old Ofri Kimron runs the kitchen at the Café Odisseia. Kimron describes Pristina, the first place she's ever lived outside her kibbutz, as a big city. She says the café's biggest problem is electricity. Since 1999, Kosovo's decrepit power company, known as KEK, has never been able to cope with the swelling demand for electricity here, and power cuts are part of daily life.
We had days that we didn't have breads in the morning, but we call KEK every night, checking which hours will have power, which hours not. And then we count in how much time I need for breads to grow and so when I need to put it in the oven. So it's tricky, but we are managing.
Even though most Albanians are Muslim, the Israelis say they feel no tension over religion. And the Israelis and Albanians in the cafe say they share a mutual trust and affinity. The Albanians here will never forget that Israel was one of the first countries to help after they were driven from their homes in 1999, while the Israelis still remember that Albanians saved thousands of Jews during the Holocaust. Back in the kitchen, Kimron is showing off her Albanian. Kosovo baker Yuli Boyupi is embarrassed when it's his turn to try out his Hebrew.
It's hard. Shalom, yeah, shalom. It's like hello.
Boyupi and other Albanians say they are proud that the Israelis have chosen to invest here. They hope other investors will follow if Kosovo becomes an independent nation sometime next year. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Pristina, Kosovo.
Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.